Omaha Public Radio presents another lecture program from the University of Nebraska at Omaha on Noon Forum. We'll hear a talk by Walter Nagorski, Professor Emeritus of Political Theory at the University of Notre Dame. He'll deliver the second annual Kent A. Kerwin Lecture in the History of Political Philosophy, co-sponsored by the University of Nebraska at Omaha Department of Political Science. The topic of his talk will be Cicero, Statesman as Well as Political Philosopher. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Thursday evening, April 4, 2013, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of the University of Nebraska at Omaha, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the program is Carson Holloway, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Nebraska at Omaha.
Walter Nagorski is Emeritus Professor in the Program of Liberal Studies in the Department of Political Science at the University of Notre Dame. Initially appointed at Notre Dame in 1964, Professor Nagorski has been a visiting scholar at Harvard, a visiting tutor at St. John's College in Santa Fe, and a visiting scholar in St. Edmund's College at Cambridge University. From 1979 to 85, Professor Nagorski chaired the Program of Liberal Studies, the Great Books Program at Notre Dame. He holds a PhD in political science from the University of Chicago. His articles on Cicero, political theory, liberal and character education, and the American founders have appeared in a number of distinguished journals, such as Interpretation, the Review of Politics, Political Theory, Communio, Modern Age, Logos, the Political Science Reviewer, and the American Journal of Jurisprudence. He's a contributor to and co-editor of, with Ronald Weber, of the book An Almost Chosen People, The Moral Aspirations of Americans, and with Kenneth Deutsch of Leo Strauss, Political Philosopher and Jewish Thinker. He is the editor and contributor to Cicero's Practical Philosophy in 2012, and he's also very well known in our profession as having been the chief editor of the Review of Politics from 1994 to 2004. Tonight he will speak to us on the topic Cicero, Political Philosopher, as Well as Statesman. Would you please join me in welcoming Professor Nagorski?
I think you probably feel all a little daunted when somebody comes up with a big sheaf of papers in their hands and wonder how long might the evening be. But I do want to begin by thanking Professor Holloway for the introduction and for all the arrangements that he's been at the center of in bringing about this particular lecture and getting me out here on this occasion. I have a special reason for delighting in the opportunity to come here and present the Kerwin Lecture. Emeritus Professor Kent Kerwin, whose continuing commitment to political philosophy at this university is represented in this annual lecture, and whom this lecture honors, Professor Kerwin contributed in an important way at an early stage of my professional life to my being able to launch a significant research and study program on Cicero. As a friend of graduate school days at the University of Chicago, and then a correspondent, especially during our early years of teaching, he read my initial work and gave me support in fellowship and grant competitions. He did this most notably in a period just after my dissertation director had passed away. It is gratifying to come to an institution where Kent Kerwin taught political theory and constitutional matters for so many years with great impact, and to offer in appreciation some of the work whose seeds he nourished many moons ago. Needless to say, if he nourished the seeds, he doesn't necessarily take responsibility for all the wild outgrowth that may have come from them. John Adams, our first vice president and the second president of these United States, made clear on several occasions his respect for and attachment to Cicero. This Cicero, who lived some 1,800 years earlier in another era of humankind, perhaps for some a more primitive era, One general statement of praise by Adams helped in selecting the title of this lecture. Adams wrote, As all the ages of the world have not produced a greater statesman and philosopher united, greater statesman and philosopher united, than Cicero, his authority, says Adams, should have great weight. Adams wrote those words in 1787 as learned and thoughtful people like himself prepared for the Constitutional Convention of that year, and as the American colonies united then in a troubled and weak confederation, explored and argued over constitutional alternatives for individual colony states as well as for the nation as a whole. Adams wrote those words in a work called Defense of the Constitutions of the United States. At that time, and in most times since he lived, Cicero's authority as a philosophical statesman did have great weight, the great weight Adams called for. Consider that Thomas Jefferson, Adams' ally in drafting the Declaration of Independence, explicitly named Cicero in his letters as one of a handful of thinkers who contributed to the tradition of public right that shaped the revolutionary philosophy of that document. Cicero's book on duties, which we might appropriately call his ethics, was regularly present in the libraries of early America. That era of the founding was a golden age for statesmanship, as President John Kennedy once called it upon dedicating the Adams Family Library. In those first years of life under the Constitution and in the administration of George Washington, James Wilson of Pennsylvania, a key participant in the Constitutional Convention and in the subsequent ratification of the Constitution, this James Wilson delivered a set of important lectures on law, which gave prominent attention to Cicero on natural law. The lectures were attended at times by President Washington, Vice President Adams, and then Secretary of State Thomas Jefferson, a formidable little group to have in your audience. If I were to document for you Cicero's great weight of authority with Christian fathers of the church, such as Jerome and Augustine, with many Renaissance thinkers, and with the likes of John Locke and David Hume, there would be no time to tell you about Cicero. This lecture would then be long on testimonials and short on substance. But what about our time and the century that has preceded this moment? It does not appear that Cicero's authority has great weight, and let us be thinking about why that might be. Surely part of the reason would have to do with factors that account also for the weak to little presence of all classical authors in our educational system. And this would have to do with a general, though usually unexamined, confidence that there are brighter lights and sounder thinkers who are of our modern age. Or perhaps, that isn't the primary explanation, perhaps we are simply busy about many things, some good to be sure, and theory and philosophy does not draw our attention. Again, to explore now, at this moment in depth, the reasons behind this general neglect would deny us the opportunity to present Cicero's thinking. What seems more significant in the context of this Kerwin lecture and this series of lectures that began with Plato last year is that even when scholars are drawn to classical political philosophy, they are apt to turn to the great Greeks and to ignore or quickly rush over the thinking of the Romans, even that of the Romans' brightest light, Cicero. So let us begin by locating Cicero as a thinker in relationship to those great Greeks, and that will draw us to notice the range of his achievements, and those two steps will prepare us well to consider major aspects of his political philosophy. In locating Cicero with respect to the great Greeks, namely Socrates, Plato, and Aristotle, we must acknowledge not a rivalry between him and them, but a form of great debt to them and considerable deference to them. In a sense, then, Cicero must clearly be secondary in more ways than chronology, and perhaps there is justice in his comparative neglect. However, we must be careful in that judgment, for we might miss his distinctiveness, and that entails specifically his being a statesman philosopher with the emphasis on statesman. And it is my task here to bring out just what that distinctiveness is, but now to continue with locating him in the history of Western political theory. Historians of ancient philosophy place Cicero at the end of a period of philosophy that began with the death of Aristotle in 322 BC. This period is called that of Hellenistic philosophy and is marked by the fracturing of the Socratic foundation of philosophy into various schools of philosophy, though perhaps a couple of these schools, namely one form of skepticism and Epicureanism, developed alongside of, rather than from, the Socratic tradition which Plato had shaped into the Academy and from which Aristotle, the comprehensive system maker, broke off to found and direct his philosophical school called the Peripatetic School. When Cicero's philosophical education began in his home, in the 90s BC, there are, besides some written works from the world of Greater Greece, Greek itinerant teachers of philosophy called on by leading Romans for their education. Cicero was exposed to and learned from Stoics, Aristotelian Peripatetics, representatives of various strains among the descendants of Plato's Academy. He encountered Epicureans too, and had a dear and lifelong friend Atticus of that persuasion. We perhaps can best understand the philosophical environment in which Cicero came alive to ideas and the search for wisdom if we notice a feature of the modern philosophical world where students might be found reporting that they encountered in their department of philosophy a Marxist, a Thomist, an Aristotelian, an analytical philosopher inspired by Wittgenstein, and a pragmatist in the mode of Richard Rorty. Would one be totally confused? Or could one learn from all or most of these representatives of philosophical schools and critically assimilate from that experience a defensible philosophy of one's own? It is such a critical assimilation that Cicero claimed to be working toward and to have at least partially attained over the course of his lifetime. Philosophy was a process of inquiry, and its specific fruitfulness for Cicero's life and the Romans who benefited from it came in the last 12 to 13 years of Cicero's life, when he published nearly all, some 18, of his philosophical writings. These writings reveal not only his understanding of philosophy and its potential range into all matters, such as those on the nature of the gods and questions of how we know, but these writings also show his basic method in operation, namely a sifting and sorting among the teachings of the philosophical schools for what seems most likely true. This commitment to a method, one of modified skepticism, associated with one branch of the academic school is explained in Cicero's words in number one of the handout provided. And I don't propose there to read that entirely out to you, but I want to notice with you in the first paragraph at number one, the third line up, Cicero writing, "We, however, whose guide is probability and who are unable to advance further than the point at which the likelihood of truth has presented itself, we are prepared both to refute without obstinacy and be refuted without anger." And a few lines into the next paragraph, "I have chosen particularly to follow that philosophical school which I think agreeable to the practice of Socrates." And the lines end with, "to look for the most probable solution." This school of the academic skeptics with which Cicero identified is the one that he not only thought most attractive, but also the one he thought most true to Socrates. Cicero sought, one might properly say, a Socratic revival in a time when life was so different from that in which Socrates walked and talked in the agora. And in Cicero's time, philosophy had taken the form, as we noted, into various schools. Cicero's time more like our time than Socrates' more primitive time of asking simple but fundamental questions in the marketplace around Athens. Cicero's Socratic orientation has been insufficiently recognized and acknowledged. This is understandable, for it is hard to imagine what might be Socratic about someone who owns villas, speaks fine orations in the Senate, and wears the appropriate formal toga. We might as well wonder how one could be Socratic in the modern world. How could one be Socratic and wear shoes and keep office hours, as we professors do, at our best? Okay. But let that be as an exercise for our imagination. By Cicero's Socratic orientation, I mean his Socratic self-understanding as a philosopher. That self-understanding is manifest in three ways, two of which we have already described, namely his appreciation for Socratic dialectical method and his attachment to a form of skepticism. Like Socrates, he tests opinions by pitting them against one another. This is the sorting and sifting of dialectic. And then he chooses that which seems best. "The seeming best is but that. It is not certainly known. But one might and one must act on it. Remember the Socrates who knows only that he does not know? I take that to mean he does not know with certainty or absolute assurance, which is a way of saying he does not truly know. The philosophical school committed to such a method and to such self-restraint and affirmation is that to which Socrates, Cicero, gives his loyalty." Now to the third Socratic feature, the one we haven't discussed, and the one that draws us into political philosophy. This is Cicero's embrace of what is called the Socratic turn. Our passage number two is one of Cicero's famous expressions of this turn. "The turn involves giving a certain focus to philosophical inquiry, a focus on the questions relevant to how to live my life and how best to order our common life together. This latter, in other words, the chief political question, what is the best constitution?" Look with me at this passage number two, because Cicero says so much more poetically than I have just phrased it, tells us about this Socratic turn. "From the earliest philosophy to the time of Socrates, who sat under Archelaus, a disciple of Anaxagoras." Those of you that studied the history of ancient philosophy know something of these pre-Socratics, as we call them. Motion and number were explored, as well as the origin and destiny of all things. Those philosophers zealously inquired into the sizes of the stars, the distances between them, their paths, and all heavenly phenomena. Socrates was the first to call philosophy down from the heavens, to set it in the cities, and even to bring it into the household. He compelled it to inquire into life and character and issues of good and evil. So there's the moral and political focus expressed most eloquently by Cicero. But long before Cicero knew enough history of philosophy to formulate such an expression of the Socratic turn, he, and most especially his father, who directed and supported his education, seemed to intuit the priority this turn implies. And in fact, as we will shortly see, they radicalized the turn to the point where Cicero elevated the life of political leadership or statesmanship over the life of inquiry or philosophy. Now let me defer for a time further comment on this radicalization of the Socratic turn by elevating the life of statesmanship. I defer so that we might locate in history another Cicero, or to be more precise, another dimension of this incredibly talented Cicero. Recall that we began seeking to locate Cicero in the history of philosophy, and we came to comment about the fruitfulness of his philosophical life, to say it, as contemporary academics might say it, by his having 18 major publications in the last 12 years of his life. Now, I propose to locate Cicero in another way and to attend to another sense of fruitfulness of inquiry, one which he explicitly endorses and one that has nothing to do with quantity of publications. Cicero is located in another way when we return to his beginnings at home and with father, and there notice that Cicero's earliest years are focused on education in rhetoric and law. Education toward possessing the competencies and skills useful for political service. This is supplemented with attention to Roman history and the exemplar political leaders of that history. It is with those skills and sense of history that Cicero made a quite remarkable political career. He prepared for it and sought it, and that career saw him ascend through the major political offices in Rome, what are called the cursus honorum, the steps to the highest office. He did these at the earliest possible date. It is as if some ambitious young person in our nation won election to the House of Representatives at the constitutionally permissible age of 25, then to the Senate at 30, and then to the presidency at 35. So it was that Cicero, after holding the necessary key offices, came to be chosen consul, the highest office in Republican Rome for the year 63 BC, when he was but 43 years old. At that point, we are still almost a decade away from Cicero's first properly philosophical writing. But Cicero had by that time given notable orations, many published. They included defenses and prosecutions and arguments for public policies as he made his way most successfully in politics. And of course, to be in politics is to be in strife and to have powerful enemies, as Caesar was for him at certain times. Cicero was nonetheless, then as now, considered a remarkable lawyer and a distinguished orator. Above all other achievements, that distinction as an orator who had a mastery of Latin prose like no other, that distinction has continued down through the ages. So, however disliked are Cicero's Republican politics, or however neglected his philosophical writings, His orations are savored and read in the ordinary education in Latin, and I trust that among us this evening are no doubt some who developed their Latin skills and vocabulary on Cicero's defense of the poet Archias or one or another of his Catilinarian orations. This is a proper moment to take a brief aside just to remind you of the resources, the exceptional resources available on Cicero's many faceted excellences. For one, more than 50 of his orations survive, and these are to be distinguished from works on rhetorical theory and the rhetorical art. Such works overlap with his philosophical works, which means, as we will illustrate shortly, that Cicero rarely writes anything about the art of rhetoric without a serious consideration of its relation to philosophy. So these seven rhetorical writings might also be classified as philosophical books. Then we must proceed to notice something else. His letters, like no other ancient figure, we have an abundance of letters preserved. We have some 900 letters, very many being those between himself and that lifelong friend Atticus. They are letters that include not only reflections on the ups and downs of Roman politics and Cicero's tactical and strategic thinking amidst political struggles, but they also include revealing information on his process of composition and then revision of his philosophical writings. They include revealing confessions of his self-doubts and uncertainties. So all of these sources, the orations, speeches given, rhetorical writings, reflections on the art of rhetoric, philosophical writings to the number of 18, and more than 900 letters, all of these sources bear on Cicero's preparations for and his means for conducting his career as a stellar statesman of the Roman Republic. So we have located Cicero in another sense, the Cicero not of the history of philosophy, but the Cicero of political history. Even though Cicero's life seems to be a two-step process, each quite distinct steps, in which the first rises through oratory and law to political prominence and leadership, and then a second stage, when his political star has fallen, he turns intensely and productively to philosophy, those last 12 years. That distinctly two-step appearance must be countered by an appreciation of how deeply he values philosophy in the first phase of preparation for leadership. And on the other side, the latter part of his life, how much he continues to elevate rhetoric, law, and the practice of statesmanship in that second stage of philosophical writings. Consider a very young Cicero's expression of the importance of wisdom. That's passage number 3 on the handout. That goal of philosophy to making persuasive ability truly useful. And from that passage, I just like to emphasize what he says right out to us. This is the beginning of a work of his late adolescence. It's approximately the age of the undergraduate students with us this evening, when he writes a work called De Inventione. Invention, as we have that carry over in our English, means find or discover, and it's a part of rhetoric to discover the right arguments, even before you try to embellish them with delivery or anything else. And so that's the nature of this work, but I'm interested in what he says as he starts off. He says, for my own part, after long thought, come now, Cicero, you're a young man, but I have been led by reason itself to hold this opinion first and foremost, that wisdom without eloquence does too little for the good of political communities, but that eloquence without wisdom is generally highly disadvantageous and is never helpful. So we see him there launch at an early age this important thematic of his thinking of trying to unify the wisdom that practical philosophy can give with this fine speaking ability called eloquence here. True fruitfulness for Cicero is the Socratic turn to ethics and politics, yielding some direction for life. In other words, not just a quantity of publications. For Cicero, a philosophy that does not do this is quite worthless. Philosophy must bear fruit in pointing up our duties as human beings and citizens. So Cicero gives us what might strike us as a puzzling combination: a skepticism guarding against assured dogmatism, joined with an insistence that philosophy must not back down from moral and political judgments that might give direction to life. What then is the radicalization of the Socratic turn, this focus, the Socratic turn being the focus on ethics and politics? It emerges from actually pursuing or taking the Socratic turn and finding on this path of inquiry a truth for Cicero that the politically active life and that of statesmanship is in fact the highest duty for humans. Let us say for most persons in most circumstances. It takes precedence over the life of philosophy, inquiry, and contemplation, which has been seemingly elevated to the first place by those great Greeks that preceded Cicero, and by so many, especially in the Christian tradition, who followed Cicero. To see how Cicero reaches such a conclusion requires that we enter his political philosophy at the very ground with what is likely his most important observation about human nature, an observation that wholly accords with the thought of those great Greeks. What I am referring to is the human being's essential social and therefore political character. For Cicero, explicitly repeating Plato more than once, says the following: man was not born for himself alone. And going along with that is the fact that man cannot be truly who he is, truly a human being, flourishing as a human being, without the aid of others and the community around him. He is a dependent being among dependent beings. It is protection and nourishment and education and discipline that can make man all he can be. Man's neediness is for more than security in Cicero's eyes. In fact, for more than the education and discipline that leads to the development of the self. Twice Cicero invokes a hypothetical example. He asks us to take a human being who has had every need satisfied and supplied in terms of security and daily wants. All his needs are provided him in his isolation. Cicero says this human being would seek to break out in search of interaction with other human beings. We need community or society, in Cicero's view, and thus we need government and authority to order that community to realize the good of happiness. Such a government is not a badge of our lost innocence, as Thomas Paine famously wrote, nor is it simply the result of a war of all against all, as another famous Thomas Hobbes wrote. Rather, government depends on a way of nature that sees government as contributing to the good by contributing not just to security, but beyond that toward the peculiar needs that relate to genuine human happiness. So what follows from this fundamental observation about a human being's social and political nature? What follows is that sustaining and developing a certain kind of community, a certain kind with respect to its laws and customs, is critical to self-development and seems to be the place where man's service to others is to find its object. Man is by nature to be a giver and a taker with respect to the community that enfolds him. What follows from this is that the greatest kind of life, the highest human activity, is one of direction of the critical communal dimension of life. This is the life of leadership and statesmanship. One must prepare for and position oneself for this service. Without such, one cannot expect to be at the helm or be able to take the helm of the state when a dire situation arises. One must get the experience at the helm in ordinary times in order to serve well in extraordinary times. Do we now wonder whether Cicero's affirming as the highest life the life of public service or statesmanship undercuts his claim that the power of rhetoric, and no doubt political power, is to be joined with wisdom born of philosophical inquiry? In other words, in plain words, shouldn't philosophy be the highest? Cicero's response to that concern is tied up with his seminal development of the notion of conscience. Conscience that allows common sense and the examples of tradition to put public service first, because we know enough about the necessities and goods that communities serve to act on this and to act on a kind of pre-philosophical knowledge. Furthermore, Cicero and some others know that philosophical inquiry can be drawn to depths and heights that pull its practitioners away from what is more evidently useful. Now, Cicero knows the delights of pure philosophical inquiry and contemplation. He is prepared to concede that it is the most fulfilling and godlike activity of the highest part of our souls. His conclusion, however, is that in most situations in this life, our highest duty is to serve the public realm, if possible as public leaders, though this is not necessarily the greatest form of conceivable happiness, because that political dimension of life entails struggle, contention, disappointment regularly, something he's acutely aware of too. I spoke a bit earlier about the need for certain kinds of communities, communities marked by certain laws and customs, as being truly the ones that serve human development and human happiness, the ones that should shape the vision or goal of outstanding statesmen. To speak this way about there being some end or goal for political communities is to reveal what common sense and all good political theorists acknowledge. Namely, one cannot set direction or expectations for political life without some richer notion of human nature than simply that which we have stressed, that human beings need community and government. For Cicero, the richer or thicker understanding of human nature is most explicit in his work on duties, where the sources of the basic virtues in human nature are explored. These virtues being wisdom, justice, courage and magnanimity, and finally temperance or moderation. Man's end and what level of happiness is attainable in this life is to live honorably or virtuously in accord with the circumstances we are given. Clearly for Cicero, political philosophy can assist the political leader, assist in a critical way in understanding more fully and becoming more able to defend virtuous ways. It allows the leader and all would-be leaders, good citizens, to see that the kind of political community conducive to such virtuous ways would be marked by overall justice. Cicero insists that without an objectively grounded justice, there can be no true such community, no true res publica, the public thing or republic. Furthermore, there is no genuine virtue without human liberty. And thus for Cicero, Consent is to play a key role in establishing and sustaining any government. Consent, of course, always for stability, but not merely so. Through Roman examples, Cicero believes he can teach Platonic principles about justice more effectively, and surely that is true for his Roman audience. Cicero holds that Roman history has yielded a government that is an overall stable mixture of democracy, aristocracy, and monarchy, where the claims of liberty and equality, excellence, and custodial care and decisiveness can be balanced in an equipoise that represents the greatest likelihood that justice can be attained and maintained. So such a mixture would represent the best constitution for most people in most circumstances. Rome points us, according to Cicero, in the right direction, though it is not without its institutional and policy failures with respect to justice. The statesman, whether leader in a founding or reforming what is inherited, the statesman comes back into our picture as the person charged above all with providing for balancing and rebalancing as circumstances require. This will, of course, often have to be done with persuasion. The statesman is not a monarch or a despot. Cicero's best order or best regime, then, is a dynamic one, more realistic than that abstract ideal which many interpreters have found in Plato's teaching in his Republic. Thus, the quality of the soul and the education of the model statesman becomes very important for Cicero, like educating the philosopher kings and queens became important to Plato. The statesman who gives himself to this high duty of the active life is, as we've said, necessarily bound up in the contentiousness of politics. Sometimes it seems like the very dregs and mud pits of life to Cicero, as well as to those who have appreciated Cicero and yet lamented that this had to be a part of his life. Cicero wants statesmen who can step back. Scipio Africanus the Younger, a man of the century before Cicero, has often served as his example of the model statesman. And our passage number 4 on the handout reveals the importance of getting perspective on oneself and one's country. Even Rome, for all of its boastful and partly just pride, is diminutive, to say the least, in the larger view of things. So you will see in passage number 4 on the backside of your handout, Cicero saying, "How can any man regard anything in human affairs either as exalted, if he has examined into the yonder realms of the gods, or as of long duration, if he has realized the meaning of eternity, or as glorious, if he has perceived how small is the earth, not only the earth as a whole, but especially that part of it which is inhabited by man." I and Dr. Kerwin and others here have lived through seeing the first pictures back from the moon to the earth. And when I saw those pictures, I thought of this passage and another in Cicero, where it's entirely through his imagination, writing in the century before Christ, he envisions, "Mighty Rome though we are minuscule in these vast heavens and among these planets." Let that shape your perspective. And you might wonder, does this passage show contempt for human affairs? Ultimately, no, because in a main expression of this, at the end of Cicero's work on the Republic, in a section called The Dream of Scipio, the result of this vision is to be told, this is something that awaits you in the future. Rather, you must go back down to the responsibilities of life in the Republic. And so carry this view in mind as to who you are and how relatively insignificant you are, but let that impact your actions in important ways. At least twice in his writings, Cicero delights in recounting that Scipio protected time to be alone and claimed he was never more occupied than when he was alone. The wisdom that philosophy might provide could come then not simply in the course of one's youthful education, but also at moments and periods of retreat for reflection. It is those moments and periods that, amidst the contentions of politics, could assist statesmen in remaining attuned to nature and the human being's place in nature. Much of Cicero's writings were understood by him as a form of public service, to offer material for those moments and periods in the lives of future statesmen and potential statesmen. Cicero served this way through his writings when he could no longer be active himself for reasons of political opposition and age. To understand the way of nature better provides that objective basis for justice and all the virtues that are critical to the wisdom Cicero offers. Especially through Cicero and the Stoic thinkers from whom he learned certain matters, the way of nature came to be expressed as natural law, or the law of nature. One classic formulation of it is our passage number 5. Given to another character, other character than Scipio, in Cicero's Republic, but true to Cicero's thinking about the ground of any appeal for moral and political right. It is what seems probably so to this moderate skeptic, and the passage, attentively read, nods at the difficulties of getting this fundamental law right as to specifics and then being compliant with it. It is an invitation to a necessary grounding of moral and political claims. It does not represent a comprehensive system known with complete assurance. There must be an appeal to nature if there be any way to correct bad traditions and to avoid simple resort to force and will. And so look at the passage. True law is in fact right reason in accordance with nature. So getting that reason right and bringing it in accord with nature might be formidable. It's present everywhere, unchanging and universal. It summons to duty by its commands and deters from wrongdoing by its prohibitions. And it does not lay its commands or prohibitions upon good men in vain. Ah, you might have to be disposed in a certain way to respond to the commands. Good men respond, though neither does it have any effect on the wicked. Our moral disposition may play a role in what we see and know. It is forbidden to try to alter this law, nor is it allowable to attempt to repeal any part of it, and it is impossible to abolish it entirely. We cannot be freed from its obligations by Senate or people. We need not look to anything but reason to explain or interpret it. And there will not be different laws at Rome and at Athens or different laws now and in the future, but one eternal and unchangeable law will be valid for all nations and all times. And there will be one master and ruler, that is God, over us all, for he is the author of this law, its promulgator and its enforcing judge. Whoever is disobedient, so people are disobedient. Natural law doesn't rest on people following it. Whoever is disobedient is fleeing from himself and denying his human nature. And by reason of this very fact, he will suffer the worst of penalties, even if he escapes what is commonly considered punishment. So in conclusion, what does this all mean for us? Consider with me that Cicero provides a rich resource for thinking about questions that seem very alive for us and for our time. How do we think about the competing claims of a life aimed at public service over against a life emphatically given to thought, to philosophy, to scientific inquiry for their own sake? That question must be very personal and tied in an important way, as Cicero concedes in his On Duties, to personal abilities and dispositions. However, we all do face the question of the ground for our moral decisions. Can we find a way to rise above relativism in a convincing fashion in order to renew a life of virtue and the virtues long associated with a free and decent society and constitution? Cicero seems to do so in a convincing fashion because there is an honest respect for skepticism on foundations in the light of the ultimate mystery of things viewed without any assistance from revelation. What Cicero seeks in statesmen, we should seek to the degree possible in all citizens. Within souls of leaders and then within society, there seems a need for tempering our democratic impulses with the wisdom of a natural aristocracy of talent and virtue. This would represent a direction, not a set of simple solutions to our problems of attaining and maintaining both justice and liberty in our free and very complex modern societies. Encountering Cicero provides, as I hope we got a taste of this evening, encountering Cicero provides us with an opportunity to step back from our time in order to step back into our time armed more with the thinking of a man who embraced both political philosophy and political service. Thank you.
Thank you, Professor Nagorski. We have time for questions. I'm instructed that because we're recording the lecture, if you have a question, please approach the microphone and address your question to Professor Nagorski through the microphone.
I'm wondering what you think Cicero would have thought of our own founding documents, the Declaration and the Constitution.
Yes. Hypothetical, of course, but you ask for it, and I think he would have been very favorable. And let me bring everybody aboard by saying this. A key principle of our revolution and our expression of our revolutionary philosophy is the principle of popular sovereignty that is found in the creedal section of the Declaration of Independence. It means that the people should decide the form of government and whether the government is fulfilling its ends or objectives. And, of course, that was the basis on which we went to revolution. Cicero talks about the legitimate republic being formed by the consensus of the people and it being legitimate not simply when it has this consensus support, but being legitimate when it is also in accord with justice or right. So Cicero had the same reservation that Thomas Jefferson had. While he articulated the principle of popular sovereignty, he also held that the majority of the people, or the people as a whole, do not necessarily determine right and wrong, ultimately. They're the best practical vehicle we have for starting government, sustaining government, respecting, we respect the liberty of the people in that. This is our revolutionary document, I think, is one that Cicero would approve of. And as I indicated in one part of the text, Jefferson pushed in his correspondence to explain his sources, named Cicero, as well as Aristotle, as well as Locke, as well as Philip Sidney, as sources for the idea of public right that the Declaration was meant to express. So I wouldn't see anything at variance with Cicero there. Now, with regard to our Constitution, it follows in that fruitful summer of 1787, that Constitution ends up looking like a mixed government. You know, a single executive looks like the fetus of monarchy, thought the opponents of the Constitution. A single executive. A Senate with six-year terms, elected indirectly. A little bit of the old aristocracy coming in there. And then a more popular House, the House of Representatives. So are we a mixed system of government similar to, but all our branches of government, those judges with their life terms are ultimately appointed by a president, approved by a Senate, and all of those offices go back to the people, sometimes very indirectly, but they go back to the people. So as one of the common teachers and friends of Professor Kerwin and myself used to put it, we appear to be a mixed government, and we have certain advantages of a mixed government, but we're a wholly republican system of government. That is, all power comes from the people. There's no monarch that has an independent channel of power. There's no senators that have an independent right because of birth to be in the Senate. Now, interestingly enough, because Cicero hasn't been closely enough examined, Cicero's view of the mixed government in Rome comes quite close to being wholly republican, because you don't get to be consul and to be elected the chief executive officer in republican Rome by some kind of grant from family status. You have to be chosen. You're chosen by a Senate, which includes people of past, have held offices in the past. You're elected along the whole line with the participation of the people, sometimes with weighted elections. It's not as purely democratic as we are. But it isn't a mixed government in the sense that it was in the heyday of the British system, where we have a combination of a hereditary monarch, a hereditary upper class in the House of Lords, and then a popularly elected lower house. You see how that's genuinely mixed, because the sources of authority do not all go back to the people as they do in our system. So what I'm saying is that I think, given a lot of changes and developments, I can envision a Cicero as being among the founding fathers and supporting the Constitution in the Constitutional Convention. Well, thank you all.
You've been listening to a lecture program from the University of Nebraska at Omaha on Noon Forum. We've heard a talk by Walter Nagorski, Professor Emeritus of Political Theory at the University of Notre Dame. He has delivered the second annual Kent A. Kerwin Lecture in the History of Political Philosophy, co-sponsored by the University of Nebraska at Omaha Department of Political Science. The topic of his talk was Cicero, Statesman as Well as Political Philosopher. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Thursday evening, April 4, 2013, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Charlie Reed, UNO Media Relations Coordinator, for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. Complete Noon Forum listings, as well as an archive of over 300 previous broadcasts, are available on our website, kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.